Today's nonfiction is I Am Martin Luther King by Brad Meltzer. I am Martin Luther King Jr. When I was little, I used to get into a lot of scrapes. One day, my little brother hit me in the head with a baseball bat. Two other times, I mistakenly got knocked over by a car. Another day, I tumbled over our banister, then bounced through an open door into the basement. No matter how many times I fell, I just kept getting back up. Even before I could read, I knew I liked books. My dad always talked about how I kept a lot of books around me. I used to tell my parents, "When I grow up, I'm going to get some big words." There is a power in words. Big words were in my future. When I was 6 years old, one of my best friends was a boy whose father owned a store across the street. My friend was white and I was black. It didn't matter to us. We would play games and have fun together. But when we started going to school, everything changed. He went to a school where all the kids were white. I went to a school where everyone was black. And soon after, he told me, "I can't play with you anymore." My dad said so. He doesn't want us being friends. I didn't really understand. He didn't seem to make sense. At dinner, my parents explained, "It's because you're black and he's white." I was so mad that day. How could someone treat me differently just because of the colour of my skin? I wanted to hate my friend and his father. But my parents told me to do the opposite, that I should love my friend even though he'd hurt me. They taught me that it's better to have more love in your life than hate. Then my mother taught me one of the most important lessons of all. You are as good as anyone. You must never feel that you are less than anyone else. I wanted to believe it, but every day I saw the opposite. I saw you could be treated differently just because of the colour of your skin. If you were white, you could go to a good school at that time, with great playgrounds and plenty of books. If you were black in those days, your school was small, sometimes with no desks or even windows. It wasn't just the schools. Black people had to use different water fountains, different elevators, even different bathrooms. In fact, on a hot day when everyone wanted ice cream, if you were white, you could sit at the counter and eat from a nice dish. But since I was black, if they served me at all, it was through a side window and they put my ice cream in a flimsy paper cup. It got even worse when I was 14. I had just won a speech competition. My speech was about being fair to all people and I was so excited. Then, on the bus ride home, a few white people got on board. They told me, "You need to give up your seats to us." At first, to stay put, it didn't seem fair, but my teacher convinced me to move. We spent the rest of the ride home standing and getting tossed about in every direction. I was the angriest I'd ever been. Every day, this is what life was like. Black people were treated terribly then. The only question was, what could I do about it? At the age of 15, I started college. By 19, I became a minister and entered seminary school to study religion. Over those years, I read the works of Henry David Thoreau and Mahatma Gandhi. Thoreau taught me about civil disobedience, how an evil system should be changed without any violence. Gandhi opened my mind to the power of love. It's using love and peaceful methods to change unfair things in society. It was a lesson I wanted to share with everybody. And in no time at all, I got my chance. In Alabama, a black-skinned woman named Rosa Parks was told to give up her seat on a bus for a white man. It was just like what had happened to me. But unlike me, Mrs. Parks refused and she was arrested. Early the next morning, I got a phone call from a local community leader. He said, "It's time to take a stand. We should boycott the buses so everyone knows that we won't accept this treatment anymore." I told him it wasn't going to be easy, but he said, "Of course it won't." It was just like Thoreau thought. Instead of using violence to protest the unfair rules, black people would use a peaceful method. We would just not ride the public buses anymore. Without our money, the bus companies would go out of business. Now the only question was, would it work? On the first day of the protest, my wife called me to the window. The buses are all empty, she said. It's working. We had to keep it going. As the head of the bus boycott, I gave one of the most important speeches of my life. The room was packed. Camera crews were filming. I had only 20 minutes to prepare. I didn't use notes. But by speaking from my heart, I found out how big words can be. The police put me in jail, saying I was breaking the law. Other folks bombarded my house. But instead of using my fists, I always kept my calm. For more than a full year, every black person in the city, and some white people too, refused to ride in the buses. That meant some people had to walk for miles, but they just kept going. There was a power in uniting together. Eventually, our peaceful protest worked. The rules were changed. Public buses could no longer separate people based on the colour of their skin. That was just the beginning. Soon, our peaceful protest sparked other peaceful protests. At lunch counters, college students organised sit-ins where they would not stop until everyone could eat together. Our methods of non-violence were so powerful, I was invited to meet with the president of the White House. But sometimes the hardest problems were right at home. Seeing my daughter cry over not being allowed to go into a certain amusement park was one of the most painful moments of my life. And it only made me want to work harder for change. Was it easy? Absolutely not. During one protest in Birmingham, Alabama, the police again arrested me and locked me in a dark jail cell that only had one window. Someone slipped me a newspaper in which white religious leaders had written an article calling us lawbreakers. Someone then snuck me a pen. In that jail cell, I wrote my own response in the margins of the newspaper and even on toilet paper. My letter from Birmingham jail was soon published as a pamphlet. Then it was in magazines and newspapers. Today it has been read by millions of people. Like I said, it's amazing how big words can be. Our message was so important, even kids your age joined us. In Birmingham, during the Children's Crusade, more than 1,000 kids, some as young as 6 years old, showed up to march. The first day, the police arrested 900 of them. The next day, 2,500 children showed up, ready to go to jail. This was our finest hour. Enraged that we were not giving up, the chief of police told the firemen to spray the children with water hoses and attack them with dogs. They thought that would stop us. But instead, the whole country watched on TV what they were doing to our children. It was a wake-up call for everybody. 90 days later, the rules began to change. Now black and white people in Birmingham were using the same lunch counters, same water fountains and the same restrooms. You could feel it in the air. More change was coming. Freedom was contagious. By the summer of 1963, an estimated 1 million Americans held their own protests in cities across the country. And a man named A. Philip Randolph suggested a massive march. People came from almost every state. They came in nearly every form of transportation. They even took off work and didn't get paid just to be there. Old people, young people, white people, black people, even children like you. They all came to Washington, D.C., gathering in an army. Why? Because they wanted change. And they knew the surest way to change the world is to work together. On August the 28th, 1963, I stood at the podium and spoke what some later called my biggest words of all. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the colour of their skin, but by their character. After the March on Washington, the President and Congress passed new laws for civil rights, but that didn't mean our work was done. Indeed, our greatest battle was still to come. It began with 600 activists as they tried to walk 54 miles from Selma, Alabama, to the state capital of Montgomery. Back then, there were rules that stopped black people from voting. If you want to change the laws, you have to be able to vote for new people who make the laws. The police had billy clubs and tear gas. They attacked our group and knocked many people down. But, as I learned so long ago, you have to just get back up. No matter how hard they hit us, we remained peaceful. Still, we didn't get through. 2 days later, we tried again, and now there were 2,500 of us. Once again, we tried. Once again, we did not get through. Did we give up? What do you think? Now it was Sunday, March the 21st, 1965, our third try, and now we had 8,000 people with us. For 2 days we marched, and the rain could not stop us. The world was watching. The White House too. President Johnson even sent troops to protect us. Exhaustion would not stop us. As we reached Montgomery, Alabama, tears were shed. But this time, they were tears of joy. In my life, people try to tell me I wasn't as good as they were just because of the colour of my skin. When someone hurts you like that, it can be tempting to hurt them back. You must refuse. When someone shows you hate, show them love. When someone shows you violence, show them kindness. To reach our goals, we must walk the path of peace. We must lock arms with our brothers and sisters. We must march together. When we do, our voices will be heard and freedom will ring. I am Martin Luther King Jr. I stand for peace. I stand for justice. I stand to help others. I stand as proof that no matter how hard the struggle, we must fight for what is right and work to change what is wrong. Whatever struggle you face, no matter how hard it gets, you must always move forward. I am proof of this. If we rise up, if we stand together, if we remain united, nothing can stop our dream. The time is always right to do the right thing.